Müller House Meeting, Sunday morning, 6th April 1975. Today is the 6th of April. It is thought by some of the great scholars who have researched into this matter that the actual Good Friday on which Jesus was crucified was the 6th of April. The crucifixion, resurrection and ascension is one of the profoundest spiritual dramas that the human soul undergoes. And it might be very well worth our while this morning to consider some points in connection with this. You may recall that yesterday in the afternoon we talked about the body. The common misconception which all human beings have is that the body with which they identify themselves and which goes about in the world bearing their own name is their personal possession and that it is a limited body. In a sense, and up to a point, it is, of course, a particular object, a living body, as we call it. But if we go deeply into it, we discover, ultimately, and can actually experience this fact in consciousness, that the word body is a word which includes the whole of manifestation, simply because there is this continuous interaction between each and every single particular part of the one total reality, the one universe. Therefore, the profoundest meaning of body is that it is in actual fact transcendence embodied. Let us consider now some of the ancient teaching which comes in the Kabbalah itself and also in the original Veda regarding body. We may equate body with existence, that which is manifest. And remember that the word existence, derived from ex, meaning out of, and sistere, the Latin word sistere, to stand or to stand out. Existence means a standing out of the unknown origin. And as any person can see for himself, whatsoever exists as such is apprehended by us in its limited, separate form, not in its universal form. The whole of existence is the body which stands out of this unknown transcendent reality. It is for that reason that in the Upanishads, for instance, Yajnavalkya says, the Supreme, the Atma, is not this, not this, not that, not that. In Buddhism, we have the doctrine of anatta. In Christian theology, we have God, the transcendent, presented as a wholly other than his creation. This is the way we can understand it. The original Kabbalah and the original Veda identified the two altogether, because if existence, the body, the supreme body, is that which stands out of this unknown ultimate transcendent reality, then obviously it belongs to this transcendent reality. And in its final ending, in terms of manifestation, means that body is once again completely resolved into transcendence itself, the one and only primordial reality. That, as far as I can see, is the limit to which man's thought about these things can possibly go. The question arises, how did transcendence become embodied? How did the infinite become constricted into so many countless, particular, separate, finite existences? And the ancient teaching runs along these lines. Transcendence, by resisting itself, produces its own container. And this container and contained, which is all manifestation, is a self-contained reality. Take a human being. He is self-contained. He is not contained inside some outer casing or some box or something, and you can take him out of this box. You can't. We are self-contained. So too, the original teaching of the Kabbalah and the Veda presents body or manifestation as the self-containment of the infinite transcendent, which means that it does it by self-restriction. This self-restriction comes into being perhaps somewhat along lines like these. Whenever there is an upsurge of creative energy, it sinks back into itself. The original creative energy is formless, it is shapeless, and it has no boundaries. But in the sinking back into itself, a boundary gets formed, and there is definition. It becomes defined. So it becomes the particular, the manifested universe. Now this, of course, the human mind cannot imagine it. But there are moments in the deeps of consciousness when you have leaped over the barrier of isolative self-consciousness, you can experience it. In the moment of experiencing, you don't know it, and you cannot know it. But when the actual experiencing is over and you come back to normal consciousness, because the mind has reached a considerable degree of liberation and you have some sort of gift for giving verbal formulation to it, then some such ideas as these emerge in the brain. and we can talk about them. So you see, this upsurge of energy, falling back into itself, becomes self-contained, becomes restricted, constricted. Now this restriction and constriction receives its ultimate form, as far as we human beings can ever see or know, in terms of what we call solid matter. That is the densest expression of this utterly transcendent, immeasurable ultimate reality, whatever it is, this ultimate energy. So body is, if you like to so call it, spirit imprisoned. It is not as if spirit is imprisoned in body, as if the spirit were a separate something which by some mysterious means or wonderful means you could take out of body. Do remember that. This spirit has become body by this self-restriction. Now this is something which none of the theistic religions of the world talk of in their theologies, because the strictly theistic religions always separate God from God's creation. But the origins of all the religions, the esoteric teachings, teach something like this. Because if they did not, if the theistic religions taught something like this, then the question of how did evil originate becomes an unanswerable question. And theologians have been puzzled through not only 20 centuries of Christian theology, but 40 centuries of theology from the days of ancient India. You can't answer the question if you say God is separate out there and is all good and all perfect. If you say that, you simply cannot answer how, if God created the universe, evil is present. But if you understand it this way, that it is spirit, it is transcendence embodied, imprisoned, and that transcendence becomes its own prison as such, then you will see the meaning of body. We can express this in somewhat easier terms to follow in this way. Supposing we take a vertical line by itself to represent spirit, the generative principle, the male generative principle, and if we take a horizontal line of the same length, this is all for the sake of symbolism, to represent the feminine receptacle of this male energy. You can talk in purely scientific terms as positive and negative forces. Or you can use biological language and say male and female. It doesn't matter what terminology you use, so long as we understand what happens. Then, here you get the first cross, the cross of existence. You see? The cross of existence. Now, when the cross of existence comes into being, the possibility of discriminative consciousness is hidden in it. Of discriminative consciousness. It hasn't come out. It is absolutely buried deep down in the densest matter, materiality. Right. By the universal process, the evolutionary process, this cross of matter, of spirit imprisoned, can be changed. each one of us is himself, to start with, this cross of matter, this imprisoned spirit. And because spirit is imprisoned in us, it has its influence on us. Now do remember that transcendent influence is non-compulsive. It does not compel. On the other hand, it cannot be resisted by me perpetually. Sometime or other, through the ordinary processes of life, in which discriminative consciousness begins to grow and grow and perceive deeper and deeper into the truth, it gradually gives way to this non-compulsive, ever-loving, ever-patient power of transcendence itself. Now, transcendence embodied in me, in you, is called in the terms of the Kabbalah, which is the parent of the whole Judeo-Christian tradition and teaching, neshama. That is neshama. In man, the individual being himself, there is of course body, then there is nefesh, which is the vital soul, the vital principle. You know how in the second chapter of Genesis it is said that the Lord took the dust of the ground and breathed, fashioned him into the shape of a man, breathed into his nostrils, and man became a living soul. It is this vital principle in the body. From being the pure cross of matter, inanimate matter, he becomes an animate expression of this energy at work. As he progresses, there grows within him what the Hebrews, what in Hebrew is called Ruah. And we have a similar word in the Zarathustrian teachings. There's an extraordinary similarity between the whole Zarathustrian presentation and the Judaic presentation. Ruah. Ruah is what is generally called the intellectual soul, the intellectual principle. It is the intellectus of Aristotle, in the various ways in which he uses the word intellectus. It's too much to go into now. We would need a whole hour or more for that alone. So, the intellectual principle is Ruah. And it is this intellectual principle which begins to understand and direct nefesh, the ordinary Aristotle and the Greeks called it, the animal soul. Now these have as their driving force the unconscious instinctive drives of the organism itself, which we have derived from our animal ancestry. And therefore, even the intellectus, the Ruah, expends its energies in drawing the world unto itself for its own pleasures, for its own satisfactions, and its own self-expression, without sufficient understanding of its relationship to everyone around and to the environment in which it lives. But this power of neshama, which if you like, is like Shiva residing in the brain itself. Shiva's home is in the brain. That's in the Kundalini Yoga system as such. This neshama is the principle that is the irresistible and at the same time non-compulsive one. You may ask, why non-compulsive? There's an extremely good reason and a very valid reason. Through man, transcendence comes to fruition in terms of self-consciousness. It's a curious thing to say, as if God were deficient in some faculty or other. But God's efficiency does not lie unrelated to God's creation, to us. Through each of the great kingdoms of nature, the divine brings into fulfillment his own dormant potentialities. All his potentialities are dormant, sleeping in the cross of matter as such. Bit by bit they all evolve and emerge. And this is the beauty of the world process. And this is why in India the universal process is called the Leela. Leela meaning the play. The play of the divine child. It's a wonderful concept. Very good. Now this neshama, therefore, non-compulsively and at the same time irresistibly influences the ruah and the nefesh and of course the body. So now, what happens is that this cross of matter, which is an exactly square cross like that, you see, changes into this kind of cross, which is the Christian cross. You see, the longer arm, the spiritual arm, and the material arm comes up here. Now the feminine aspect is always associated with the material arm for the simple reason that it is the feminine principle in nature which bears, nurtures, sustains, and wants to preserve material form, material manifestation. In human life too, it is generally speaking, the wife, the mistress of the household, who does the work of preservation, sustaining, and trying to continue what has been found to be good. And it is the male who is the one who expends and wants to get rid of this, that, and the other, and find new ways and new things and so forth. This is very generally true, I believe. But this creative principle in all existence, this creative principle at work, is a principle which has no hesitation in wiping out old forms. That is why when God works, as they say, you find in the Old Testament the Lord God as the thunderer, as the one who destroys things. When he finds that they are not good enough or not useful enough, there is the vengeance of the Lord, as we call it. But it is not revenge, remember. It is a power of destruction which the male principle uses without hesitation, because the form is now outworn. It's no longer required. So out with it. Whereas the feminine principle would like to continue the same old form and obstruct the finer development and further growth which the male creative principle can bring into being. You have the same in India. Shiva, the third person, the Holy Spirit, which is the principle which concerns itself with all manifestation, is called destroyer-regenerator. Shiva is the destroyer of the old universe, and he is also at the same, and he's the ascetic, the lord of ascetics, and he is also the lord of reproductive nature. So you see, these deep concepts, which are embodied in the theologies of the world, are wonderful concepts which tell us what happens in our own self as we grow and come to fruition, final fruition. Now, there comes the point when Ruah, the intellectual principle, wakes up and begins to perceive and begins to understand what is happening and what is the way of life, the way of fulfillment. And when that happens, you and I begin to understand the meaning of death. Death is not destruction. Death is not the portal to annihilation. Far from it. Death is the door of transformation. And this death, when the mind becomes sufficiently enlightened that it can see this, this death is something which takes place every single moment of our lives. Because without that death, there is no growing into something profounder, something nearer the heart of reality. Now, of course, in the religious texts, they have always talked of the pulse of life as consisting of life, death, life, death, life, death. And as you all know, I far prefer to call it life, other life. Life, other life. Because the word death is associated in our minds with total annihilation. That's what it is associated with. And to console ourselves, we build up a hereafter in which this postulated immortal entity, the self or the soul or the spirit, continues to exist as an unchanging entity. And this is entirely untrue to the original deep esoteric teaching. This life, other life pulse means this kind of thing, that in the life aspect of the pulse, shall we say it vibrates like that, in the life vibration there is the manifestation of transcendence embodied in the particular, the finite. In the other life vibration of the pulse, you see, transcendence is infinite. It's no longer finite. It is manifesting non-being. So you get the being, innumerable beings, and the one non-being in this pulsation, this creative pulse of life. So that any one particular finite thing or being, whatever it is, when it enters the other life pulse, loses all limitation, all finitude, and becomes infinite. And if the finite becomes the infinite, it loses all identifiability. You cannot identify the infinite. The infinite is the immeasurable, where there is no separation. Here, transcendence is embodied as Firoz or Antony or Ingrid or Diana and so forth. Transcendence is embodied that way. But in the other aspect of the pulse, the creative pulse, that transcendence embodied in the finite manifestation becomes the one infinite. Then there is no Firoz, there is no Antony, there is no Diana at all. Now this is a terrible doctrine, terrible teaching, because it frightens human beings. They just can't understand it. Now why does it frighten us? It is because the feminine aspect of our natures wants to preserve the separate identifiable entity forever and ever. But if you want to preserve the separate identifiable entity forever and ever, we have merely become stagnant. Then this is the supreme meaning of evil in the uttermost spiritual and metaphysical sense. This is why Plato identified the female principle with evil and the male principle with good. You study his dialogues very carefully and you will find this doctrine brought out. And of course, naturally, people, especially all women, have strongly rebelled against Plato for making such a statement. What, we are the principle of evil and the men are the principle of good? No, you have to look at it this way. A female living being or a male living being, both of them have the male and the female aspect in them, together. In the male body, generally, maleness predominates. In the female body, femaleness predominates. But each one of us has both those aspects together. Now, when we understand these things, and we bring the male and the female aspects in our nature into perfect balance and harmony, then we have realized here and now the simplest and the first meaning of the marriage made in heaven. This is one meaning. This on its transcendent level, and this is perhaps most wonderfully expressed in the Kabbalistic teachings and in the Old Testament, especially in Genesis. It is also expressed in considerable detail in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. On the transcendent level, this male and female principles in everlasting interactivity, in what I have chosen to call in my own book timeless conjugation, is on the universal scale. So now, when the mind begins to see this and its aspiration at last can reach out to its own true star of destiny, then one begins to realize that I realize that for myself. I realize that I myself start as the cross of matter, and I myself grow into the cross of Christ. The Christ principle within me begins to open out completely, step by step. Now, this is the crucifixion in its profoundest significance. The relinquishing of the finite particular form, body, in order that whilst living in the body, transcendence is liberated in full self-consciousness. This is the purpose of our existence. Transcendence coming to full self-awareness through us as man. Understand this and you will have light, complete light, which will enable you to understand statements like, God so loved the world that he sent his alone begotten Son. And Jesus comes and lays down his life, his body, as a ransom for the many. In laying down his own body, the manifested form, Spirit, transcendence, God the Father, is liberated simultaneously out of the many at the same time. Because there is a principle of vicariousness operating right through the universe, simply because we are interrelated. Whatsoever I say, whether you believe it or not, whether you go against it or work with it, etc., you have been affected, aren't you? The principle of vicariousness means just that. That any one thing, any one energy affects everything else in the universe simultaneously. So now, here is perhaps the profoundest significance of this, of crucifixion. What does it mean in terms of our own personal religious living and religious discipline in everyday life? Here we see a wonderful complementary presentation in Christian terms of what the Buddha taught in his own terms. You know those wonderful words of his to his beloved disciple Ananda? Ananda, the cessation of all grasping is the deathless state, is indeed nirvana. It's immortality. It is the ultimate fulfillment. Nirvana. The cessation of all grasping. Now what is it that you can grasp at? We can grasp at something finite, something particular. Whether it be a physical object or a person. Whether it be a thought, an idea, a belief, a state of mind, an experience, an emotion. Whatsoever it may be, it is a finite something. It is confined to the cross of matter. It is confined within the limited sphere of mortality. If I cease to grasp at it, then I realize the deathless state. Why? How? What is the actual rationale of it in one's own inner consciousness? You become aware of this life, other life pulse. This tremendous life, other life pulse. If you try to grasp, the consciousness remains enclosed in darkness and is not in tune with this creative pulse of life. But be in tune with this creative pulse of life, and the petty, mistaken meaning of death as annihilation or destruction is completely transformed. This is why it is said that Jesus triumphed over death. He conquered death. And we have the identical sort of teaching in the Upanishads too. That this is the end of death. And the Buddha says it quite openly. How does he start his actual ministry? His very first words are, "Hearken, bhikkhus," that is, monks. "Hearken, the deathless has been found." Now, what can be more full of an obvious, natural hope, so to say? I'm using the word hope, but it is good enough for the purpose. This is the absolute certainty of our existence and of our development and so forth. And the key, therefore, is not to grasp. When I do not grasp, then the crucifixion, which means the relinquishing of that which is already present, not holding on to it, and wanting to keep it and preserve it. Let it go all the time. Let life flow quite freely all the time. The relinquishment, which is the crucifixion, is immediately involved, completely involved, with the liberation into the transcendent reality. And this is the meaning of immortality. In the immediate moment, which is immeasurable, which cannot be separated out. This is immortality. This experiencing in consciousness. Now you see how different this is, how completely different, transcendentally different from the usual misconception of continuing through time and space without a physical body in some marvelous form and entity which is which we label a pure mind, a divine mind, or a spark of God, or some such thing. How can you catch hold of a spark of light? There's no such thing. Light is light, it is total. God is God, absolute, total. Non-being, which expresses, presses out of itself innumerable beings, each of which comes back into the total non-being. You see the supreme mystery, this pulsation between the finite and the infinite. Of course, when I say pulsation between, naturally it sounds as if they were separate. But they are not separate. These are the deep mysteries. And these were the sort of mysteries which were revealed in the old mystery cults. Egypt had it. Greece had it. And of course, it exists in all the esoteric teachings of the world. So, grasp at nothing whatsoever. Be awake, completely awake. And if the mind and heart have the basis of absolute purification, then this transcendent consciousness, with its extraordinary creative pulse of life, other life, will function within your own psychophysical organism. Then whatsoever you are doing, whether you are joking with your friend, laughing, or enjoying music, or whether you're cooking a meal, that awareness never leaves you. You constantly abide in that awareness of transcendent reality, this great pulse. But the moment the untrained or the impure aspect of nefesh, the vital principle, or of ruah, the intellectual principle, which after all does define and confine too, you see, if there is ever any upsurge of that, an intrusion upon this transcendent consciousness, then you have lost it. Now, we can understand those last words of Jesus on the cross. Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is usually translated as, my God, why hast thou forgotten me? I will try and suggest the key, the central reality of this word Eloi. This is the key word. When Ruah and Nefesh are completely purified, completely in harmony with each other, when the male and the female aspects in our own being are in perfect poise, then Neshama, the transcendence itself, which resides in us, this non-compulsive and irresistible Neshama, permeates your entire organism. If thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light. Here is the meaning. Your whole being radiates transcendent energy, radiates transcendent reality. Now, this unified Neshama, Ruah, and Nefesh is Eloi in you. This is God manifested in you. That is why Christianity presents Jesus as the Son of God, who was God, God himself made manifest on earth. identically the same is taught of Sri Krishna. Krishna is God Himself on earth. And similarly of other great teachers. They are called Bhagavan. In orthodox conventional Buddhism, we don't use the word God, Ishvara or Ishvara, simply because that is associated in the popular mind with the idea of a separate being who creates the world and is outside the world and so forth and so forth. But it's a strange thing that Buddhism calls the Buddha Bhagava. The Hindus use the word Bhagavan. It's the identical meaning. And one of its profoundest literary meanings is simply this: the fortunate one, the happy one. Isn't it extraordinary? So there we are. So this Eloi is God embodied in you. Now, there comes the point when the supreme relinquishment and renunciation has to take place. You know how Jesus constantly talked of his Father and himself as being continuously in communication. There comes the point when the supreme archetypal energies and images in the mind of the individual man have to be relinquished. The great archetypal energies which function right through the universe have been symbolized in all the religions as archangels, angels, and the great powers of the messengers of God and so forth and so forth. You find it all through. In Buddhism too you find it, especially in Mahayana. If you look at the psychocosmic universe of Buddhistic thought, you will find it all there. All the devas at the different levels of excellence and perfection. But these different devas, we may roughly translate it as angels for our purpose now. These devas are all associated with the varying states of consciousness of the individual himself in meditation as he makes his way towards the supreme communion, where it is said that he touches nirvana with the body. So you see, you have the same sort of thing in the Kabbalistic teachings, the great archangels, and how they govern the different things. You have the same sort of presentation in the Rig Vedic gods. You have the same sort of presentation in the deepest aspects of the Greek pantheon and in other such pantheons too. Now, when you have to relinquish that, that is supremely difficult. Because these are already in a transcendent atmosphere and transcendent level. And the consciousness of one who is still alive in the body is unable to let that go easily. But this is the supreme relinquishment that has to take place before the perfected Holy One realizes the utmost that can be realized through this living body, which is the body of a man. And this is the great agony, this crossing of the abyss, as it is called in the Kabbalah. And in the Kundalini Yoga, the crossing of the abyss, as you raise Shakti right up to the level of Shiva, that last passage is the most difficult of all, because manifestation holds you hard. You are alive, you've got a body, and it feels as if you will be completely disrupted. And then there is that last experience of the fear of the Lord. That's the ultimate experience, the ultimate fear. There is still a feeling as if death in the sense of annihilation will overtake you. And it's a terrible agony of the soul. But pass through that, and there is only triumph. Elohim has not deserted you, has not forsaken you. It is all there, but it is there in perfect silence. And if you can stand that silence and know it, then transcendence has fully manifested itself through you in that state of consciousness. So this is rather unfortunately translated as the conquest of death. It is not death which is conquered. If you want to personalize death, the Lord of Death, as they do, for example, in both the Hindu and the Buddhist teaching, Yamaraja. Yamaraja is the Lord of Death, you see. If you want to personalize death, death is the immortal twin of life. Death is the other face of life. The reality is eternal life. And so, this extraordinary, dramatic presentation of what happens to the individual as he realizes his supreme perfection is presented in Christianity as in no other religion. No other religion has this kind of presentation. It's marvelous. But it needs a transcendent strength within your own soul, really to enter into it and understand it. And this strength is one which doesn't strive, remember. It is the strength of infinite resilience. That which is infinitely giving is indestructible. If you draw your sword and slash the air about, nothing happens to the air. You can't hurt it. You can't slash it. And if instead of air you just conceive of space, it is driven home to one's mind even more forcefully. Well, how much more forcefully it gets driven home when transcendence itself is concerned. So this strength is the strength of infinite resilience. Completely give, and therein thy will, not mine, is fulfilled.